So what we tried to argue yesterday that based on ADS2 CFT1 correspondence, we can arrive at a specific prescription for computing the degeneracy associated with the black hole horizon. And the prescription essentially went as follows, that we first compute the partition function of the full string theory in the ADS2 time scale near horizon background, and then try to express that partition function into a product of a finite piece and an infinite piece, but the infinite piece would have a very specific form. It should be of the form exponential of some constant times the length of the boundary. Because in that case, this can be reinterpreted as the effect of the ground state energy, okay, which can be removed, and then the horizon is just a degeneracy of ground states in the dual CFT1. So this was a prescription we arrived at yesterday.
The ground state energy thought wasn't universal in some sense. Is there special?
See, typically the ground state energy, of course, is fixed by the BPS condition. Like if you think of the energy as something measured from infinity. But what you are calculating here is a measure energy as viewed from an observer at the asymptotic ADS2. And that energy depends on what kind of boundary terms you add. Right? So as, at least within the context of ADS2, if you add, if you have some freedom in choosing the boundary terms that you add to this action, that will change the ground state energy by a constant. Right, because the boundary terms will give transfer proportional to L. Okay. But this term will not change. So in this sense, this is more universal than the energy of the ground state.
Yes, too, that may, you know, lead to a prescription for a favorite set of boundary terms or perhaps no boundary terms.
Yeah, see, even in that case, I'm not sure that you can get the ground state energy because the mass of the BPS state depends not only on the near horizon geometry but also on the moduli which are at infinity. Right? So from that point of view, the ground state energy is the mass of a BPS state is not a well-defined object. Or it's a well-defined object for at a given point in the moduli space. But it depends on where in the moduli space you are in. Right? So that is one reason why I feel that it may not be possible to really extract the ground state energy from this. But I have not really thought about it very much.
If you wish to say ground state energy, in some cases it can be fixed by a BPS condition. In some other cases it is fixed by first order thermodynamics. If you impose that, it can fix it. Can I ask also?
Yes.
So why the subleading term is L to the minus 1?
Okay, we'll see in examples the classical level when you did the analysis, it was of order 8 to the minus 1. Mm-hmm. And because the classical analysis, we found that we have this difference comes because cos hyperbolic is not the same as sine hyperbolic. Mm-hmm. But the difference between cos hyperbolic and sine hyperbolic goes as 1 over cos hyperbolic. Yes. So, as long as you can represent, you can think of this as coming from
integrating a local effective action. It will always be of order L to the minus 1. Because you just apply Wald's formula, or let me go back a little bit. Okay, so the question is to what extent we can, imagine that you can write it as a local effective action. Okay, integral of a local effective action. Now, of course, we have said earlier that because of the infrared divergence, you cannot first calculate the one-way action, then try to calculate the entropy. So one can ask, what regulates the infrared divergence on ADS2, on this near horizon background? Okay. If, for example, the length L was necessary for regulating the infrared divergence, then you expect to get terms of order log L corrections, right? Because L will enter the infrared cutoff. But what happens on ADS2, or in this background, is that the infrared divergence is regulated by the curvature of ADS2, not the size of ADS2. Okay, ADS, it's the standard fact that on ADS2, a massless field actually behaves like a massive field, right, on any ADS space. So as a result, you can still think of this as an integral of a local quantity, okay, but that local quantity is not when I say it's an integral of a local quantity, it's the integral of something. So the structure that you get is you have the integral over the ADS volume of something. This can have infrared divergence, okay, but those infrared divergences are regulated by the size of ADS2, which in this example, let me it's V. So you'll get terms of on a log V here. Okay, but not again, not log L. And now you again replace this integral of E to X by the standard cos hyperbolic eta naught minus 1. And this becomes sine hyperbolic eta naught minus 1 plus order 1 over L. Okay, so that's the reason why in practical computation the corrections that you get are of order L inverse. Because the infrared divergence is really regulated by the size of ADS2, the curvature of ADS2, not L. Is that point here?
This is not a non-shell, right? When you write down the sections, that just as a, you regulate it and then you take a pass integral afterwards.
Yes, but in practical computation, what you do is that you don't have to, you never have to actually put in the regular
the size of the boundary in explicit computation. The size of the boundary always comes, the point is any determinant, say one loop determinant or even two loop result, if you calculate the log determinant of this, this can always be written as integral d2x of something. Okay. The question is whether this something, whether this integral is convergent or not. Okay, whether this something extends all the way to the boundary. Okay. And what you find is that this object, what comes here, is x independent. Simply by the symmetry of ADS2. So the only question is whether this is well defined. If this was not well defined, if this had this itself had infrared divergence, then we cannot, we have to actually put in the cutoff and evaluate this path integral. But what you find is that you never get a divergence in this integral as long as you are on ADS2. That's the determinant, the log determinant, for example, you can always express as integral of something which is finite, but it blows up in the limit when V goes to zero. Or when V goes to infinity, that's the size of ADS2. Right? It has log V corrections. So the infrared divergences are all regulated by the size of ADS2 rather than the cutoff that you put in. Yeah? Yes.
And so in some sense, I can think of a state as an on-shell. On-shell property,
okay.
But in the gravity, everything that's, you know, if there is a gravitational background on shells, then you can always rewrite it as a boundary term.
Yeah.
So in that case, it would appear that.
See, the point is, we are not directly counting states here,
right? This is a procedure for counting states, but we are, the way we are doing this counting, that we are relating a path integral to something on the boundary. Right? So it's not. Exactly. Yeah, you just evaluate the path integral and we reinterpret this as trace of e to the minus beta h in the boundary theory. Right? We are not really trying to identify individual states in the gravity description. And that certainly doesn't seem to be possible in the Euclidean formulation. Right? Even in the Lorentzian formulation, it's not clear that you can identify individual states in the gravity description. Are there any other questions on this? Okay, so let me now go ahead and ask the question about the weighted degeneracy that I introduced earlier. Okay. So to put things in context, let's first note that in string theory, one often finds vacua with discrete symmetries. And here I have given one simple example, but there are many examples of this kind. So consider the string theory that you get by taking heterotic string theory and compactifying six of the directions on six circles. So heterotic string theory on a six-dimensional torus. This theory has a large moduli space. okay, which is obtained by simply changing the scalar field values at infinity, various scalar field values at infinity. And as you move in this moduli space, as you change the vacuum expectation value of these scalars at infinity, what one finds is that on spatial subspaces, the theory develops discrete Zn symmetries. And in fact, for this particular theory, the specific values of n that one gets are these. Okay, and we'll be focusing on Zn symmetries, which commute with supersymmetry. So imagine that we have one such theory. We are working on one of the spatial subspaces where you have a discrete Zn symmetry of this kind. And suppose G is the generator of that Zn symmetry. And we can ask, how can we calculate this object, trace horizon of G? Okay, trace of G, so instead of calculating the horizon degeneracy, we want to calculate the total number but weighted by G. So the question would be, what macroscopic computation should we carry out? I'll be describing the microscopic computation of this in the next lecture. But what macroscopic computation can we carry out to calculate this? So what we'll do is to follow the same logic that we described yesterday. So to calculate this object, trace horizon of G, what we need to calculate is trace of G in the dual CFT1. So calculating trace of G in the dual CFT1 essentially corresponds to putting a G-twisted boundary condition on the various fields as you go along this circle. Right? Because this circle is the Euclidean time of the dual CFT1. So in order to calculate trace of G, we have to simply insert a G here. Okay, which corresponds to twisting the boundary conditions by G. So this, in turn, can be reinterpreted as a partition function on ADS2. This is the basic ingredient of the ADS-CFT correspondence. So this can be reinterpreted as the partition function on ADS2. But this time, we have to put a G-twisted boundary condition on various fields under theta goes to theta plus 2 pi. Okay, that as you go around the circle here, we must put G-twisted boundary condition. Other than this, the asymptotic boundary condition must be identical to the original near horizon geometry because nothing has changed. The charges have not changed. You have the same ensemble, okay, same fixed set of charges. Okay. The only thing that has been changed, that has changed, is insertions of this G. And by following the same argument as before, we can say that the finite part of this partition function should give us trace horizon of G. Are there any questions?
The black hole language, what are we actually computing in the microscopic?
It's trace of G on the order ground states.
No, that's from the boundary point of view, right?
Yes. But so from the black hole point of view, you have this, so you have the path integral in this near horizon geometry.
No, I also understand that from the point of view of the ADS2 path integral. But from the black hole point of view, you were initially counting some entropy of the black hole.
Yes.
Now you are trying to compute what exactly?
Okay, so given black hole describes an ensemble of microstates,
yes,
for a fixed charge,
among that ensemble of microstates, the G quantum number is distributed. Right? Not all states in the ensemble have the same G quantum number. Right? So what you are asking is that what is trace of G? Okay, of course, if you can calculate trace of G, you can also calculate trace of G square. Right? So this basically tells you how the G quantum number is distributed, what fraction carries a given value of G quantum number.
Exactly.
So I have a question about the twisted boundary condition. Okay. So ADS2 is okay. So it's contractible. It's a disk.
Yes.
So how do you put the twisted boundary condition?
Yes. So that's a very good point. So that's the next slide.
You cannot put a twisted boundary condition. Okay. That because ADS2 is contractible. Okay. You see that ADS2 at eta equal to 0, which is at r equal to 1. That's the center of ADS2. The metric is perfectly smooth. And as a result, a G twist under theta goes to theta plus 2 pi is not admissible. Okay, because it's a perfectly smooth point in the interior, and you cannot have a twisted boundary condition. So this would say that the ADS2 times S2 geometry is not a valid saddle point of the path integral. Okay. Now, if this was the end of the story, okay, then one would conclude that this trace of G must vanish. Because trace of G doesn't receive any contribution from anything. Okay, is this
one here? However, this is not the end of the story. Because the rules for ADS CFT correspondence tells us
that in defining a partition function, we have to fix the asymptotic boundary conditions which match onto the ADS boundary condition. But in the interior, we are free to sum over all possible geometries, okay, all possible configurations. So one can then ask, are there other saddle points which could contribute to this path integral? So what kind of constraints do we need to put on this, on such saddle points? First of all, this is what I have already mentioned, that it must have the same asymptotic geometry as the ADS 2 times S2 geometry. Then it must have a V-twist under theta goes to theta plus 2 pi. And a third point is technical, but it's important for the examples that we'll be studying, because most of the examples that we'll be studying are supersymmetric examples. And because we are considering supersymmetric examples, we have to ensure that whatever saddle point you are considering should preserve sufficient number of supersymmetries, because what happens is that if you break a supersymmetry, associated with that, there will be a fermion zero mode. So when you try to carry out the path integral, if there are some additional fermion zero modes, which are not cancelled by something else, then integration over those fermion zero modes will make the path integral vanish. Right? So even if you can find a classical saddle point, okay, which satisfies these first two requirements, the fermion zero mode integral will simply make the path integral contribution vanish, and hence it will not be very useful. So that's the third condition, that we must preserve sufficient amount of supersymmetry so that the path integral doesn't vanish trivially because of the fermion zero modes. And then the question would be, are there other saddle points satisfying these constraints?
Well, not necessarily. We'll see what exactly it means. That it should, the saddle point must be such that
it comes with this natural prescription that there is a G twist around the theta, as theta goes to theta plus 2 pi. And we'll see. I mean, it's roughly what you said is correct, that it should have a non-contractible cycle, but it's not strictly a non-contractible cycle. Okay, we'll see what, I mean, once you identify the saddle point, it will become clear what this is. But clearly, if you have a non-contractible cycle, that's sufficient. It's not necessary, but that's certainly sufficient, because then you can put any twist that you like. Okay. So here is the construction of the saddle point. So what we do is that we take the original near horizon geometry of the black hole, which is the ADS 2 times S 2 times K. Okay, assuming a spherically symmetric black hole in four dimensions. And now, we take a Zn orbifold of this background, with Zn acting simultaneously on ADS2, S2, okay, and the internal space. Okay. So what is the action of Zn on ADS2? It corresponds to 2 pi over n rotation in ADS2. Okay, so basically the theta coordinate, the Euclidean time coordinate that I described, theta goes to theta plus 2 pi over n. You also, at the same time, perform a 2 pi over n rotation in S2, okay, and you can do it around any axis, okay, so you can imagine that you fix the north and south pole, okay, and simply make a transformation, phi goes to phi plus 2 pi over n. Okay. This is not necessary only if you worry about supersymmetry, okay, it looks like, it turns out that in order to preserve supersymmetry, we must have both these transformations simultaneously. And finally, we also include a G transformation in this orbifolding.
Okay, so
you are considering here specific case of four dimensional black holes which had an ADS 2 times S2 near horizon geometry. S2 was the angular part. Yeah, that's where S2 is part of K, but if you think of this is the angular part of the. Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Now we have gone back to four dimensions. Because if you just think in two-dimensional language, then you can think of this as some kind of internal transformation. Right? Because S2 will have an SU2 gauge field in ADS2, and it is one of the SU2 transformations that you make. Okay, are there any questions? Okay. Now, if we had done this transformation in flat space, okay, so imagine that you have a flat two-dimensional space, two-dimensional disk, and we take an orbifold by a rotation of this type. This will certainly change the asymptotic geometry. Because an orbifold of this type, what it is going to do is to introduce a conical defect. And the effect of the conical defect is felt at infinity, because you can simply take a vector and parallel transport it around a closed circle at infinity, okay, and the vector will come back not to itself, but with a rotation. Right? So this orbifold, this an orbifolding of this type, if we perform it on a two-dimensional flat space, will not preserve the asymptotic boundary condition. But it turns out that on ADS2, this orbifold does preserve the asymptotic boundary condition. Okay, so I'll explain how it comes about. So let's see what this geometry really is. And for this, it's best to make a rescaling. Okay, the geometry becomes transparent if we use a rescaled coordinate. So you define a new coordinate theta, which is original theta over n, and a new coordinate r, which is original r times n. So first, let's see how the metric looks. Okay, this is a metric. Okay, it's an absolutely straightforward exercise to check that under a rescaling of this type, the metric takes this form. The orbifold action, which was theta goes to theta plus 2 pi over n earlier, now has become theta goes to theta plus 2 pi, okay, because of the rescaling by n. Okay, rest remain the same. So now you see that in this coordinate system, theta still has period 2 pi, and the metric that you see here in the asymptotic region, namely in the for large r, this has exactly the same form as the original ADS2 metric, right? Because the original ADS2 metric was this n replaced by 1 here and here, but that's clearly sublating. And one can easily verify that the deformations that these signify, the fact that n is not 1, the departure of n from 1, that deformation of the metric is a normalizable mode in ADS2. Okay, so this is a valid saddle point, okay, because you are supposed to integrate over these modes in a path integral in any case. The fact that we have a G transformation as theta goes to theta plus 2 pi means that it provides us with the correct boundary condition. Okay, given any field, it must satisfy the boundary condition. In this orbifold background, okay, it has to satisfy the boundary condition that as you go around the circle at infinity, it changes by G transformation. Finally, we see that this period, this identification is not normal. In the original ADS space, or in the ADS 2 times S2, the identification was simply theta goes to theta plus 2 pi, and separately, phi goes to phi plus 2 pi. Here, theta goes to theta plus 2 pi has been accompanied by phi goes to phi plus 2 pi over n. So naively, one might think that this violates the asymptotic boundary condition. But the reason that this is okay is the following. Okay, that this shift, phi goes to phi plus 2 pi over n. Okay, let's view it from the point of view of the ADS2 space. In this case, the rotation on the sphere is like a gauge transformation. Right? Because once you dimension reduce on a sphere, you have an SU2 gauge field on ADS2. So you are like performing a gauge transformation. So you can reinterpret this shift, okay, by a change of coordinates as switching on a constant value of the gauge field at infinity. Is this point clear? Or I mean, if you want to see it explicitly, all you have to do is to define a new coordinate phi, which is phi minus theta over 2, theta over n. Okay, that coordinate will just not shift under this. But under such a change, there will be no constant g theta phi switched on. But we have already seen earlier that the constant mode of the gauge fields are normalizable modes in ADS2. Right? The electric field modes of the gauge fields are not normalizable, but constant modes, switching on a constant gauge field at infinity, is a normalizable mode. When you are doing a path integral, you are supposed to integrate over all values of the constant mode at infinity. So because of this, this saddle point that you have described here does satisfy the correct boundary condition that is required of ADS. Okay? And it also has at the same time a G twist.
point of view, so is this true that this orbifold is singular?
Yes, so this orbifold is singular, then orbifold singularity ontology, but that's an allowed singularity
instance here. Right? That's why this is an orbifold, this is an allowed background. So this, it can be thought of as a perfectly smooth classical solution instance here.
On the Wilson line, the phi direction is contractible, isn't it?
Phi direction is contractible, yes.
So why can I introduce a constant cage field?
Yeah, so the point is, so we have the, where are the singularity? So the Higgs points are at the center of ADS2 times the north and south pole. Okay, so these are singular points. But these singularities are of a very specific type, these are the orbifold singularities. Locally, the geometry has the form of C2 mod n. Okay, because this is a complex, one complex thing, this is another complex thing. And these are singular from the point of view of classical, that's normal gravity. But in string theory, these are perfectly smooth objects. Sure. And so that's the reason why these are abysmal classical solutions in string theory. If you're just considering an arbitrary theory of quantum gravity, these might not have been an abysmal solution.
Sure. Okay.
So, got any other questions?
So now, given that we have identified this saddle point, we can now go ahead and try to evaluate the path integral. And a leading contribution is, of course, coming from the classical action. Okay, so you can ask, what is the classical action associated with this saddle point? And it's not hard to see that the classical action is given by the world entropy divided by n. And the division by n is simply a reflection of the fact that you have taken an orbifold, a Zn orbifold. Okay, so the action that you get for this saddle point is just 1 over n times the original action of the original ADS2 times S2 background, which you know is S1. Okay, which you have seen in general that it was S1. So you get a contribution of S1 over n. And so this gives a very specific prediction of what trace horizon of G should be. Namely, it should go as exponential of S1 over n. And this will verify next time against the microscopic analysis. But this gives a very general prediction, namely that if we have a discrete symmetry, a discrete Zn symmetry, then trace of G, okay, to leading order for among the black hole microstates, okay, this is of course certainly not true in a general statistical system, but if the system under consideration is describing the microstates of the black hole, then this says that the trace of G goes as nth root of the entropy or of the degeneracy. Now this result is surprising from a statistical viewpoint because you notice that this number is much, much smaller than the total number of states. So what this says is that the Zn quantum numbers must be extremely delicately distributed among the microstates of the black hole so that a charge of order unity, okay, G, the eigenvalues of G are all of order unity, right? It's 1 e to the 2 pi I over n, e to the 4 pi I over n, and so on. That's what you're averaging. Okay. Nevertheless, averaging that over exponential S world number of states, we get a number that is much, much smaller than the total number of states over which you're averaging. Okay, it's given by exponential S world over n. So this is a prediction of the macroscopic analysis for this system. Okay, are there any questions?
Can we go back one transfer? So in the orbifold action, there's a G there. And I thought you were going to tell us that that was an action on the some internal space, maybe a T space.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But you didn't talk about that at all, so somehow it's not.
Yeah, see, it doesn't really matter because, I mean, even if G was the action on a physical space time, right? Imagine that it's actually acting on the compact space, K. Dividing by taking the Zn orbifold, okay, will give an action which is always 1 over 8 times ordinal action.
Okay.
Right? Because you have the full, I mean, it's a gain dance in the volume integral, and you are just dividing it by N.
Right.
Okay, so whether G is an internal symmetry or actual symmetry acting on space time, the order folding always gives you one more n factor.
Okay.
But quantum corrections will.
Yes. So quantum corrections, of course, will change this. But quantum corrections are essentially due to the order forcing modality. Right? And those don't have factors of area. Factors of area, right? Because those are localized on the horizon, right? So they are quantum corrections of order 1. Okay? Which basically means that this result that you have, of course, you receive corrections of order 1 in the exponent. Okay? But this is the part that is proportional to the area. Right? And that is the dominant part.
Go back again.
Yes.
So the second one, the phi, if I think about the CFT1, your quantum mechanics, you had, you're, by saying there was an S2, you're saying there was some global SU2, and this is making some identification under that symmetry. And you're doing it to preserve supersymmetry, but can you say a few more words from the point of view of the CFT?
Yeah, so from the point of view of CFT, what's happening that model R2DSLL in the CFT1,
the ensemble that we are using is fixed charge. Which in this case also includes fixed angular momentum. Because angular momentum is one of the electric charges from the point of view of ADS2. So if you are using an ensemble at fixed angular momentum, right, then the rule for calculating path integral over ADS2, that you fix the asymptotic value of the corresponding electric field, right, or you fix, because d theta phi will in general, for a given angular momentum, it will go as r. If you want zero angular momentum, then this must be zero. But once you have put this boundary condition, then g theta phi is no longer fixable. Right? You have to integrate over g theta phi. So in any case, you are not fixing the given saddle point doesn't come with a fixed value of g theta phi. You are supposed to integrate over this. Well, not the given saddle point. A given ADS2, a given prescription, okay, requires us to integrate over g theta phi. And in that space of integration, we find one particular point, which is a saddle point. Right? That's what this means, that you are supposed to integrate over the constant value of the gauge field anyway, and this picks up one particular constant value of the gauge field where you have a supersymmetric saddle point.
Is this point okay? Okay, are there any other questions on this?
This is a kind of general question suggested by what you're doing. So you're telling us that in string theory, I mean, if we just want to do the gravitational path integral, you're telling us that the rules for singularity or not singularity of the saddle point are different in string theory. So I'm just wondering whether there's any more general ramifications of that. I mean,
okay, so I think whether it is different or not, it depends on what particular quantum theory of gravity you are dealing with. Then it's certainly possible that there are other quantum theories of gravity where these are supposed to be allowed singularities. Right? Is that string theory comes with a very specific prescription that these are perfectly allowed singularities in string theory. These have been used for finding compact spaces and so on. But this doesn't rule out the fact that the other theories of quantum gravity might also have these as allowed configurations. But is that you have to, work with some particular quantum version of gravity to decide whether these are allowed or not.
But so I'm just wondering if you know of any examples where one would have to rethink the Euclidean calculation of black hole entropy because some new saddle points would become available, which would have been regarded as singular from the Einstein gravity point of view.
Yeah, certainly in string theory there are many such examples. And because even the leading saddle point can also get contributions in the order for singularities. Imagine that you here, I looked at this saddle point, and suppose I didn't include this G.
Right.
Okay, that would be a perfectly good saddle point which contributes to the original G horizon.
Yeah.
Right? And those have to be included in this analysis. Again, in gravity, I mean, in some theories of gravity, this may not bear out configurations, and they shouldn't be included. Mm-hmm. See, in string theory, one can certainly find examples of this type. But in the generic theory of quantum gravity, I don't even know how to ask this question. Okay? Till the rules are clear.
Right. So, among, do you know of any examples where we have to change our opinion of what the entropy is because of this effect?
Okay, so these are of course subleading, as you can see.
These are subleading, but there might be another.
Yeah, okay, I don't know if I have an example correct. Like that. I mean, you really have to have a correction of all, which is bleeding. Yeah. So, all such corrections, because they are all defaults of the original saddle point, they always give subleading contribution. Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't know of an example where there's a leading correction to the entropy. And any other questions? Okay. So let me now mention the second kind
class of applications, which are just standard perturbative corrections to the horizon. Okay, and let's consider, for example, the effect of one loop correction. Okay, Yes.
Is there something that you can say about the overall coefficient that's sitting in front, or?
Okay, that would require calculating one loop quantum correction, right? In principle, yes, if you could calculate one loop quantum correction in solving for background, but that has not been done. An invincible calculator. Okay. So, as I have already said, okay, that when you look at one loop correction, you can of course try to do the whole thing at once, okay? Because string theory allows us to do one loop calculation without splitting it into massive and massless states. Okay? But that has not been done because we have what is called Ramon-Ramon background in here, and the one loop corrections are not well understood. At least the techniques are not well developed for dealing with such backgrounds. But what we can do is to divide this calculation into two parts. So first of all, the effect of integrating out the massive modes. These can be regarded as a modification of the effective Lagrangian density. That we first look at what the massive modes, what the integrating of the massive modes give as what contribution it gives to 1 PI effective action. And then, because this contribution is local, we can accommodate it using Wald's formula on this new effective action. So the formalism that I described really becomes relevant when it comes to studying contribution from the massless modes. Okay, and these, as I have already said, cannot be incorporated directly using Wald's formula because the 1 PI effective action is non-local when you have massless modes. So what it requires to calculate the contribution from this to the horizon entropy or the horizon degeneracy is essentially finding the eigenvalues of the kinetic operator in the near horizon geometry and then calculating the determinant. Right, at one loop, that's all you need to do. Calculate the determinant of this massless excitation. So I'll not give the details of the analysis. Okay, I'll come back to this in the next talk when I make the comparison of the microscopic results. But as an example, let's consider a massless scalar field with standard kinetic term, okay, by which I mean it's the phi box phi kind of kinetic term. And you put it in the near horizon ADS 2 times S2 background for a spherically symmetric extremal black hole in B equal to 4. In this case, it turns out that all the eigenvalues and eigenfunctions can be explicitly calculated. Okay, the eigenvalues and eigenfunctions of the Laplacian on ADS 2 as well as on S2 are completely known. So you can calculate the eigenvalues and eigenfunctions of the Laplacian and calculate determinant of this box operator. And then use it to calculate the one-loop contribution to ADS2 partition function. The calculation is straightforward. As I said, it just requires looking at the eigenfunctions and calculating the determinant. But the final result is that you get a contribution to log d horizon of this form. Okay, so this is one-loop correction to log d horizon. So leading order, log d horizon is just Wald entropy. And then you get a logarithmic correction of this kind from a single massless scalar field.
is the area of the horizon. Okay, or in this language, is the size of ADS2 or S2, which are the same.
Okay,
it's A over the UV cutoff, which is in this case is the string scale.
This is the minimally coupled scalar.
Yes, okay, the point is in this case, I mean, you can ask what happens to a conformally coupled scalar. In this case, it doesn't make a difference because on ADS2 times S2, R is equal.
If you take ADS2 times S2, right, the supersymmetric black holes have equal size of ADS2 and S2. Okay, so R is zero. So whether you take minimally coupled or conformally coupled scalar, it's the same result. Now, in general, this calculation is more complicated because if we have a black hole in supergravity or super string theory, the kinetic operator for the fluctuations around the near horizon geometry mixes all the fields, right? The scalars mix with vectors, vectors mix with tensors, and so on. So essentially, the problem is technically complicated. Okay, one basically needs to diagonalize the kinetic operator, find the determinant, and then compute the contribution to Z radius 2 and hence the horizon. Okay, but the method is absolutely straightforward. You have to just calculate a determinant of this box operator by solving for the eigenvalues and eigenfunctions. Okay. So I'll describe some of the results of this in the next time when I actually try to compare the microscopic results. Okay, but this is the general procedure that one can follow to calculate one loop correction to the horizon.
Log areas thing.
Yeah.
So since you have a cutoff there,
yes.
And so to begin with, the conformal the Weyl tensor and EDS2 times S2 is zero. So there's some conformal invariance.
Yes.
But then this correction is going to explicitly break conformal invariance.
Okay. Let me put it. Yes, sir. See, what we're calculating here that once you have integrated out one a scalar field, conformal inference is broken, right? So it's, yeah, you are right. The fact that they're integrating the scalar field gives a contribution to the conformal anomaly. That's what is responsible for this term, right? Because integrating out the scalar field will give a contribution. I mean, okay, what is T mu mu? T mu mu has term proportional to R mu nu, and R square, right? Okay, I think R mu nu rho sigma, R mu nu rho sigma term cancels, but there are two terms. And this is zero, okay, but this is non-zero. Right, so one gets the contribution from here. But, so one could, in principle, try to do this calculation just by using local conformal anomaly, okay, but that is not completely crucial because one often encounters zero modes which have to be subtracted out. Okay, and that causes some additional complication, but if you know the determinant explicitly, if you know the eigenvalues and eigenfunctions, you can just calculate it by calculating the determinant.
But then if you consider the contribution from all the massless fields.
Yes.
And if your underlying theory is conformally invariant, won't that contribution to the log term vanish?
Yes. Provided the zero modes work out correctly. Right? But the point is in this case the underlying theory is not conformally invariant because take a supergravity theory. Right? You're not just quantizing super young waves in that background.
Oh, is it?
Because I mean what you have is a coupling between see, the supergravity effect, low energy action is not the same as the supersymmetric field theory effective action. Right? For example, in supergravity, the F mu nu term, the Gibbs field kinetic term, has term proportional to the scalar. Right? So, it's not the same as doing the calculation in a normal field theory log gravity in the black hole background. But in principle, you can redo this calculation. A TVU calculation with this, modified action, and then calculate these coefficients and calculate the resulting coefficient from that. Are there any other questions? Okay. So the last part of the talk,
Okay, I'll now address a different issue, which will be useful, which will be necessary for comparing with the microscopic data. Okay. And this issue comes from the following fact, that you will see that when you carry out the microscopic analysis, this will always be done in a region of the modelized space where gravity can be ignored. Okay, we'll take the spring couplings to be sufficiently small where gravity can be ignored. And as a result, when you carry out the microscopic calculation, the regime in which you will carry out the calculation is the one in which the states do not form a black hole. So how can you compare these results with the result from the black hole side? In order to compare the microscopic results to results from the black hole side, we must focus on quantities which do not change as we change the coupling from small to large value. And this requires that we deal with appropriate supersymmetric index and not degeneracy directly. So what I'll do is to first explain what particular supersymmetric index is relevant for the problems that we'll be dealing with. And then I'll describe how black holes can be used to in fact make prediction about the supersymmetric index. Okay? The degeneracy formula that I gave can be turned into a formula for the index for the black holes. So the appropriate index in four dimensions, okay, in supersymmetric theories in four dimensions, is what is known as the helicity trace index. Okay, so I'll now try to describe what this index is. Yes.
Since that I became recently confused. So there is this, all these developments when people study superconducting phase transitions and quantum critical behavior. So in some sense, those are the transitions that occurs at zero temperature. And in a gravitational description, there is this ADS2 process to region.
Yes.
However, the whole point of the phase transition, as you change the coupling, the spectrum of the theory changes dramatically. In particular, the index will change. Well, I mean, the degeneracy will change because some of the levels will go down to, I mean, this just a standard picture of this quantum phase transition.
Yeah.
So is there some stronger argument here that because you're looking at the supersymmetry that somehow protects you? Why don't you worry about this quantum phase transitions?
Yeah. See, the point of the index is something that that is protected against such changes, right? The index can jump under certain circumstances, but how much it jumps is highly confident. And there is a specific formula which tells you the 1% formula that how much the index will jump. Right. So that is the reason why we look at the index in the first place. That is, it shouldn't be sensitive to what kind of hack you have and so on as you move in the modelized space.
Okay, So I guess you would be able, on a gravity side, you would be able to compute like traces of very specific operators.
Yes.
But not...
Yeah, see, we can calculate on the gravity side trace of anything that you like. Mm-hmm. Except that may not be comparable. I mean, you may not compare that with the microscopic results. Right? You can only calculate trace of some very specific objects on the gravity side, in which you can then compare to the microscopic. And those are the objects which are protected by supersymmetry.
And I guess also because presumably here what helps is that you're looking at the, you're basically counting the ground states.
That's it, yeah.
So that's
exactly. Yeah.
So are you saying this index might not be preserved exactly, but it jumps in a way that you can...
Yes, very good control, exactly. I mean, it jumps, you know precisely when it jumps. And how much it jumps, right? I mean, that's given by this wall crossing formula. So you know, besides what subspace of the modelized space, the index can actually jump, and then you can calculate how much it jumps by. Okay. So let me then explain what this index, what is the index that you calculate? So let's imagine that you have a BPS state
which breaks 4 n supersymmetries. Okay, typically BPS states are described by how many supersymmetries it preserves, but we can also describe it by how many supersymmetries breaks in a given theory. Now, for every broken supersymmetry, there will be a fermion zero mode. Yeah, these are the Goldstein modes. So, if the BPS state breaks 4 n supersymmetries, then there will be 4 n fermion zero modes on the world line of the state. So, when you try to look at the quantum states, that the quantum states of this of such an object, then quantization of the zero modes will produce Bose-Fermi degenerate states. Okay, in particular, if you have a pair of fermion zero modes, then when you quantize them, you get a two-fold degenerate state, one of which is bosonic, one of which is fermionic. So if we try to calculate the usual Witten index, okay, which was designed to capture the number of vacua, okay, trace minus 1 to the f, where f is the fermion number, this will vanish because there will be degenerate Bose-Fermi pair of states. Right? Minus 1 to the f will get 0 from 1, or minus 1 to the f will get contribution 1 from the bosonic state and minus 1 from the fermionic state. So what one does instead is to define a new index, okay, which is non-zero but nevertheless protected, which I'll call the helicity, the 2n helicity trace index, B2n, and this is the definition. So it's trace minus 1 to the f, but there is an additional insertion of helicity, okay, or twice the helicity. Why helicity in this case is just the third component of the angular momentum in that S frame of the particle. Now, what is the effect of inserting a factor of 2H? Okay, so let's again take a pair of fermion zero modes. Okay. We have said that it has a degenerate pair of ground states. Okay, one is bosonic, one is fermionic. So minus 1 to the F has opposite values on these two states. But if you now also calculate minus 1 to the F times 2H, right, then 2H has different values for a bosonic state and a fermionic state. Right, the 2H differs by 1 between these two states. So while trace of minus 1 to the 2f would vanish, trace of minus 1 to the 2f times 2h will not vanish. Okay, and so for every pair of fermion zero modes, trace of minus 1 to the f times 2h will give a non-vanishing contribution. So if there are 2n pairs of fermion zero modes, okay, then once you insert a factor of 2h to the power 2n, you get a non-vanishing contribution to the trace. But at the same time, we notice that if the state breaks more than 2n pairs of supersymmetries, if it breaks more than 4n supersymmetries, there will be more than 2n pairs of fermion zero modes. And if there are more than 2n pairs of fermion zero modes, then this trace will vanish because you simply don't have enough factors of 2h to soak up all the fermion zero modes. So this is an index which receives contribution from states which break 4n or less number of supersymmetries, but which it does not receive any contribution from any state that breaks more than 4n supersymmetries. Are there any questions on this?
So how do you get the third, second inequality minus 1 to the f to be 1 minus 1 to the 2h?
Okay, because f is 2h. Oh. Then because if h is odd, then f is it's harmonic if H is equal to bosonic. Okay. So here is an example. Okay. For most of our studies, we'll be on quarter BPS black holes in N equal to 4 supersymmetric string theories in D equal to 4. This preserves 4 out of 16 supersymmetries. So quarter BPS means that it on 2. And N equal to 4 supersymmetric string theory in D equal to 4 has 16 supersymmetries. So a quarter BPS state will preserve 4 of the 16 supersymmetries. So this means that it breaks 12 supersymmetries. And so the relevant index that we'll have to calculate, we have to use to analyze these states is B6. Okay, and this can be repeated for any BPS state in any supersymmetric string theory. That you just count how many supersymmetries are broken by that particular state, and you can identify what index you should use to capture the spectrum of those states. Are there any questions? Okay. Now, since on the microscopic side you compute an ADS, because
this is what is protected, okay, and this is what you will calculate on the microscopic side, we must ensure that on the black hole side also we compute an index. Because if we try to calculate a degeneracy on the black hole side, we cannot directly compare it with an index on the microscopic side. Right? They are to begin with different objects. So the question would be, how can you use the horizon degeneracy for which you have already found an expression to compute the index B6 on the black hole side? Is this here?
Now, perhaps I should not go through the rest of the argument today,
okay, because it's already getting late, but I'll illustrate the basic reason why we can compare the two sides. And the logic is roughly as follows. Okay, I'll make it more specific, I mean more detailed next time. So the idea is we are trying to calculate, say, trace of, suppose you are trying to calculate trace horizon of minus 1 to 2H. Okay, effectively we will see that what we need to calculate is trace horizon of minus 1 to 2H. Okay, the fermion zero modes are all outside the horizon and you don't have to worry about those. Okay, but we'll make it more specific later. Now, we have already said that the ADS to partition function calculates the degeneracy or whatever trace of anything in a microcanonical ensemble. Okay, all the charges are fixed. So this is in fact nothing but minus 1 to 2H horizon times trace horizon of all the states in the ensemble that have been counted must have the same value of H horizon, okay, for a given black hole solution. You can of course have black holes of different angular momentum, okay, in which case H horizon will differ from one black hole to another black hole. But for a given black hole, this is fixed. For a given black hole horizon, this is fixed because this is we have to fix all the charges. That's the rule of ADS CFT correspondence. So the question is then, what can you say about H horizon? And here the supersymmetry comes into play. What one can show is that the supersymmetry in D equal to 4 implies that H horizon must be 0. And as a result, if you are trying to calculate this over the microstates that describe the ensemble, if you are trying to calculate this trace over the black hole microstates, we actually can identify this just as D horizon, because H horizon is forced to be 0 by supersymmetry, and the ensemble that you are using is really a microcanonical ensemble for a fixed H horizon, and that shows that it's just D horizon. The angular momentum carried by the horizon, by the black hole horizon. So the, just like the charges are fixed by the flux, right, the QIs. So we had, if you remember these QIs that we introduced, right? So these QIs run over all electric charges in ADS2. And those, this will include in particular the angular momentum. Because after all, from the ADS2 viewpoint, right, we have, so imagine that you have dimensionally reduced the theory on S2 times ADS2 times Carabian. Right. So from the ADS2 viewpoint, the dimensional reduction of gravity on S2 gives some gauge fields, right? This gives you SU2 gauge fields. And the electric charge of this SU2 gauge field is the angular momentum. Is that, yeah? Right. So just like you introduce this QI, okay, for every electric field, okay, you must also include the corresponding GIs for the SU2 fields. And we must work at a fixed value of those quantities, right, of these charges. And now the question is, which values are compatible with supersymmetry? And what you can argue in four dimension is the supersymmetry forces the black hole horizon to be spherically symmetric, and hence the only possible charges, only possible angular momentum that are compatible with supersymmetry is zero. Yeah, so that's the crux of the argument, that even though you began by evaluating this, okay, first because you are using a microcanonical ensemble, all states have the same value of H horizon, so you can pull this out of the trace. And then you can argue that this must be equal to 1 by supersymmetry. Okay, but next time maybe I'll try to make it more formal, because we also have to worry about what happened to this factor of 2H to the 6, which was in the trace. Right? And we'll see that this actually is saturated by something which lives outside the horizon. So as far as the horizon is concerned, you really need to calculate just this.
I guess my question will be more relevant when you will be talking about that. You will see that only that one is such. I guess you will be able to see on the gravity side that as well any other index other than B6 will vanish. And then on the CFT
yes.
side, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it just depends on how many formal zero modes you have.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because on the gravity side, in this case, you have.
Right, and then
a certain number of formal zero modes, and
so it's roughly you are saying the same counting as on the field theory side, counting the supersymmetry.
Except that there is a difference that here, what we are counting the horizon always has zero angular point.
Mm-hmm.
This is not true for the microstate counting. In the microstate counting, there are states carrying various angular momenta.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but you have to, when you calculate the case, there are cancellations between these various angular momentum states. And while you calculate B6 as after you have taken into account all the cancellations. On the gravity side, there is no cancellation because in the horizon, okay, the horizon always has H horizon equal to 0. So if there are black holes carrying different angular momentum, then this case would get different contributions from different black holes of different angular momentum. And in the final answer, they could have cancelled. Okay, but that doesn't happen on the black hole side.
Is your argument that if you treat the metric as a background and you demand supersymmetry, then you reduce to a spherically symmetric black hole? Or is there something more? Is it more?
Yeah, okay, it's based partly on the algebra. Basically, the point is. The point, what? This is not true in all cases, but in the wide class of examples. So the point is that we have the fact that we have an ABS2 means that we have isometric group. Includes SL1. Okay, because SL2 is an icon asymmetry of ABS2. So in the horizon geometry, this is the postulate, the extremal black hole should always be defined as the one which has an ABS2 factor. Now you can ask what are the unbroken supersymmetries. Look at the unbroken supersymmetries. In this example that I just described, there are four unbroken supersymmetries. The four in number. Now, take the algebra that is the closure of this supersymmetry algebra and this SL2. So, what one finds in the closure of 2D plus SL2 generates a bigger algebra which is for ESU112. We don't need to know what this is, but the point is that this includes SL2R. Transition. Okay, this is an important point. So, just as a consequence of supersymmetry algebra, you are forced to have an SU2 isometry in the near horizon geometry. And SU2 isometry means that your angular momentum must vanish. And that, I mean, it's known from classical analysis that supersymmetric black holes in four dimensions do not carry angular momentum. But this is a more, this is more general than classical analysis in a specific class of theories. It does follow from the algebra that if you have four unbroken supersymmetries and if you have SL2 isometry, you must also have an SL2 isometry for the value. That and this implies that the horizon must carry the angular momentum.
So this is stronger than just saying you have a classical spherically symmetric black hole, because that might have microstates that had non-zero angular momentum.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is really a consequence of supersymmetry algebra. So the classical result that you see is a consequence of a more general argument based on supersymmetry algebra.
So there's some assumption that supersymmetry can remain unbroken. I'm not quite sure.
See, we are counting quadratic pieces. Okay. First of all, in the vacuum supersymmetry, the 16 supersymmetries remain unbroken. That is an assumption, and I think that is, has been tested in many examples. Now the question is, what states do you want to count? And here, by definition, you want to count only those states which preserve at least four of the supersymmetries. Right? Because you're looking at a quadratic PS index. And if you calculate in particular this V6 index, any state which breaks more supersymmetries than this will get zero contribution anyway. Okay, so you must count. So V6, we automatically count states with four unbroken supersymmetries. And now we use the fact that we have four unbroken supersymmetries and that we have SL2 isometry in the near horizon geometry to conclude that we must also have an SU2 isometry in the near horizon geometry. And once you have an SU2 isometry, it forces the horizon to be spherically symmetric and hence has zero angular momentum.
In some sense, on the gravity side, you're picking up by hand only those contributions to index which are not vanishing by restricting to quadratic BPF black holes.
Yes.
Now, on the field theory side, in principle, you can trace over all states, even those are not necessarily a quarter BPF supersymmetric, but only they will not contribute to V6.
That is true, but even states which are quarter BPS, right, with different angular momentum on the field theory side, can cancel.
But, so that's what I want to understand. So, how those states, so if there are those states, in whatever, you know, in the subspace of the Hilbert space that is important for that trace, how do they are reflected in this gravity computation?
See, it's not guaranteed that those states will survive by the time you have come to the gravity description.
Mm-hmm.
Because only the index is protected, so even if there are more one quarter BPS state in the field theory limit, in the limit where gravity is switched off. Therefore, this basically says that those states must go away. An index doesn't protect them. That, and you don't see those states explicitly in the gravity description.
But if I do the same silly thing on the field theory side, if I restrict only to tracing over a quarter BPS states with H equal to zero, will I get an agreement?
No. You will not. Because that's a different answer.
Okay.
So that basically shows that this is not protected. If you want to calculate trace with H equal to 0 state,
right,
that is not a protected index. You see, in order to get a protected index, you must trace over H, different values of H.
Okay.
So if we just try to count states in field theory,
mm-hmm,
often that is a bigger number than what we get from the black hole side.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but once you calculate a protected index, you get the result which agrees with the black hole.
Okay, you were just saying that the instance where I did this horrible truncation to H equals 0 on the CFT side, I already lost the fact that it's an index.
Exactly.
So it's
exactly
no longer protected.
That's it.
And doesn't,
yeah,
is not supposed to agree with this.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. Right? In five dimensions, you can do a little better because there are two angular momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And you can fix one of the angular momentum and trace over the other one. Okay, that then you can compare the corresponding black hole side. Okay, there again you can fix one angular momentum and trace over another one. But in four dimensions, there is no way to compare states of a fixed angular momentum on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a protected index.
Can I ask another question? So typically in the tractor mechanism, there's an enhancement of supersymmetry at the horizon. So
yes.
Won't how does that affect your...
Yes, no, it's already included in this. The point is that the enhancement automatically is seen in this. Right? When I said the four supersymmetries, which are the unbroken supersymmetries of the original black hole, we decide to add, generate this, right? This actually has eight supersymmetries. Right? And it's basically the reflection of the fact that the supersymmetry algebra, the unbroken supersymmetry doesn't commute to the set four. Right? So once you start computing, they generate automatically new elements of the supersymmetry algebra. And then the anti-commutator of those with the original generators generate this.
But in the actual path integral, when you're evaluating, when you're doing the fermion zero mode,
yes,
integral over the fermion zero mode, then are you doing two separate integrals, one at infinity and one at the horizon, or what exactly is going on there?
Yes, basically, you can, what you can do is that you can divide the path integral, so here is the horizon here. And here it has to be infinity. You can divide the path integral into the path integral over the horizon modes, and then the path integral over everything outside the horizon. Okay, this we will call here.
Oh.
And the point is that fermion zero modes are sitting here. Okay, you can see that the fermion zero modes don't live inside the horizon. So, yes, integration over the fermion zero modes have to be saturated by inserting something. Yeah, and that is this VH to the 6 factor. Okay, but this VH to the 6 factor must saturate here. Fermion zero modes, and that's why inside the horizon you don't have any VH to the 6 factor. Like here you only have another minus 1 to the 2H. There is no minus 1 to the 2H.
But B6 has both these factors, right? So when you compute B6, the horizon doesn't contribute because H is 0 or?
Oh, okay. Maybe I'll show you the formula anyway. I think it will be clearer. Okay, so this is the picture that you have. Say, generally configuration will contain multiple horizons and then also the here outside. Okay, and the fermion zero modes are here. So now, the point is when you calculate E6 for example, okay, you start by this, but this trace now you divide into trace over the horizon modes and the here modes. Okay, the modes which are inside the horizon and the modes which are outside the horizon. So the H you can write as sum of H horizon and H here, and this also is H horizon and H here. And now the point is because all the fermion zero modes are in the here. To get a non-zero contribution from the trace over the here modes, you have to pick H cap to the 6. You see, imagine that you have done a binomial expansion of this.
Yes.
Right? Any term that contains less than 6 factors of H here will give you 0. Because there are 12 fermion zero modes living in the here. So the result of this, and furthermore, H horizon is forced to be 0. Because of supersymmetry. So the result of this is that effectively you can relate B6 to the space. Okay, you drop factors of H horizon from here and there.
But your earlier argument required that to match it to D horizon that you computed earlier. It was this trace minus 1 to the 2H only.
That was 0. That was 0 if there are formula 0 modes. So, yeah, I'm coming to that. So, let's look at this formula, right? What all you have done is that because H horizon is 0, I can just drop the factors of H horizon from this. This is trace over the horizon 0 modes, it's trace horizon of 1.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There is no dependence on the horizon modes here.
Yes.
Right? And as far as the here modes are concerned, it's just trace here of this whole thing.
Yes.
Right? So that's this formula that you get the, as far as the horizon modes are concerned, you just get the horizon. Right? And then you get the B6 of the PI, which you have to calculate separately. Right? That's the general picture. So you divide the trace into trace over the modes which are living in the horizon and the ones which are living outside the horizon. And then all the complication is essentially taking the trace over the modes which are outside the horizon.
Factorize, so they just factorize.
Exactly, yeah.
Maybe I should ask next time, but there's something related to Dennis called halo. Is it the same as a halo?
No, it's not the same as halo. I think halo is basically this picture that a generic configuration, right, can have multi-centered black hole configuration. Right? And I don't think what he describes as halo is if you have one center and then multiple centered black holes around it. Right? Not again. But once you have a multi-centered black hole, you automatically have non-trivial categories of freedom.
So you're saying, well, halo represents many...
Many black holes.
Many small black holes.
Many small black holes around some black hole.
Maybe it's named after the halo in the galaxy or something like that.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, because you had this picture that, I mean, you have the bouncing of one black hole with n other smaller black holes. Yeah, and those n black holes which can, whose wave function spreads out on a spherical shell. Yeah, and that's what you call the halo.
So you have to sum over all configurations to get B6 over your top?
Yes.
At the same?
Yes, on the microscopic side, you just calculate B6 without worrying about quite. Whether it's a black hole or non-black hole or anything, right? So now we'll try to calculate the same thing on the black hole side.
Yes.
You fix asymptotic charges, and you need to sum over all possible configurations. Right? Often the dominant contribution, particularly in the n equal to 4 theory, the dominant contribution comes from single-centered black holes. But if you want to get an exact result, you must sum over single-centered, two-centered, three-centered, all possible black hole configurations.
And compute B6.
Compute B6, yes. So, for each, so this is the general formula for B6. That you sum over all possible centers. A is the number of centers.
Okay.
Then for each term in the sum, you find all possible of the distribution in the total charge into the KR and the horizon. Okay, that each horizon can carry charges Q1, Q2, etc. Here can contain certain charge. So you find all possibilities of distributing the charge into this, and you have to sum over those possibilities. And for each, you then take the product of the contribution from horizon degeneracy and the contribution from the KR index.
Is it possible to compute this B6 here or not?
Yes, it is possible because here modes, see, what are here modes after all? Here modes are supersymmetric excitations around the black hole background. And so that is often you can calculate explicitly. You take a black hole solution and you ask what are the supersymmetric fluctuations around the black hole solution. Those are the supersymmetric here. And those are often possible to find explicitly. And in many examples, the only hair modes are the fermion zero modes associated with broken supersymmetry. Okay, so those you can easily find. But in general, you can calculate the hair modes by simply doing small fluctuation analysis around the black hole background. And then these numbers you calculate specifically by calc on by doing the mass integral about each horizon. And each horizon has its ADS2 geometry. And then we put the results together to get the total contribution to the index.
Do you know that there are no supersymmetric instantons or other things without horizons that...
Without horizons?
Yes.
Yes. In some cases, there can also be a solution without horizon, right, which could contribute. But often, what happens is that there are examples where... Okay. It's not enough to just have solutions. You have to make sure they contribute to the index. If they carry too many fermions, zero modes, then they will not contribute to the index. So often we have fine solutions, but they have too much fermion, zero mode. Okay? And hence they don't contribute to the index. But if there are solutions which do preserve the right number of supersymmetries, then you have to include their contribution as well.
And you can characterize all those? Or?
In principle, yes. Okay? What is it for n equal to 4 system that we will be dealing with? Okay? You can argue that the major contribution always comes from single-centered black hole.
Okay, so it's just in the dot. I mean, I certainly agree that the dominant contribution is from the
yes.
Black holes.
Exactly.
Okay.
But otherwise, if you want to calculate the full contribution, you have to really identify all possible supersymmetric smooth solutions,
right.
Supersymmetric black hole solutions, and put the results together.
Right.
Because that's the complete set of configurations on the macroscopic side.
So is that what you is that what you're going to do, or are you just going to argue the dominant contribution?
Yeah, I'll basically look at the dominant contribution.
Okay.
Right? And certain subdominant contributions also have been found. Hmm. Right? For example, certain two-centered contributions. Maybe if I have time, I'll two-centered black holes are subdominant. They're in fact exponentially subdominant. But in the microscopic formula, you can explicitly identify a contribution from this, right? Even though they are exponentially subdominant.
But why should it, I mean, I'm the same question. Why should it be that everything can be found perturbatively about some classical solution? Why can't there be other states that are just purely quantum? Or?
Okay, it depends on what.
you can look at the purely quantum states from the microscopic side, right? Where you represent them as D-brains rather than gravity. Mm-hmm. What you are asking here is how to count them from the gravity side. Okay? And the idea that you think of this as quantas in classical K-space. You look at the space of BPH configurations on the gravity side, which could involve, non-trivial stringy mechanism. Okay. But you first find the classical configuration, classical phase space of BPS case on the gravity side, and then get the result by geometric quantization.
So how do you know that that's the right procedure, or how do you know you're not missing some states by limiting to those?
Well, at least the experience shows that you always get the right answer as far as counting of BPS states by quantizing phase space of BPS configurations. Yeah, so that's the idea, that you try to get count states by simply quantizing the phase space of BPS configurations.
You get the right answer in the leading approximation, but now you're claiming...
Well, you also get some subleading. As I said, this, for example, the single, in N equal to 4, the single centered lateral entropy goes in equally Q square. These two centered configurations go as equally Q. But Q is the generic charge. So this is far exponentially subleading compared to this. Nevertheless, in the microscopic formula, you find precisely this contribution. That you can identify this contribution in the microscopic formula. So it is true that one has not calculated both sides exactly and compared. Okay? But many features of the microscopic formula you can see on the black hole side, just in terms of classical configurations. Right? This, for example, as I said, is far exponentially subdominant compared to this. Right, but nevertheless, you can see this on the microscopic side. And the idea is to explore how far we can go this way. Right? Maybe we'll find that this doesn't give the complete results, and then you have to change our rules. Right? How to look for quantum states on the gravity side. Any other questions?